The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Oncologic palliative care is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard. There has been a movement in the boards over the course of the last 10 or so years to try to incorporate some aspects of palliative care and hospice in the board process. And so one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we spent a little time covering was oncologic palliative care. Sherry and I have a wonderful opportunity of serving our communities and our profession in a manner that allows us the opportunity to improve the quality of patients' lives. But the reality is that a substantial proportion of our patients still don't survive their disease. For many of them, we do oncologic palliative medicine on a daily basis. And so it's a good crossover area, and it's also an area that's target-rich for board examination questions. And so what we're going to do is spend some time this morning just kind of covering some various aspects of that, and we hope you'll find it's beneficial. So we're going to talk a little bit about palliative chemotherapy, a little bit about palliative radiotherapy, and then some of the common symptoms that we're going to cover. So the question sometimes comes up, well, gosh, Kev, you know, palliative chemotherapy is really rough. You know, it can be really hard. You can affect patients. Why would people want to do that? Well, there are probably about three or four reasons why we would think somebody would want to pursue that. And one is that the patient really wants to do something. Doctor, I hear what you're saying. I know this is a disease that I have a life-limiting prognosis, but I want to do something to fight it. Or a situation where maybe there's prognostic uncertainty. Well, Dr. A thinks I might not live so long. Dr. B thinks I might do actually a bit better. And so I'm not really sure what to think. So I think I'd like to talk about what my options are. An attempt to decrease symptoms. I'm having pain referable to my cancer. I'm having shortness of breath and I'm coughing up a little bit of blood. I'd like to do something about that. Or they're from a culture that really promotes treating rather than doing nothing. And so they see that comfort and quality equal doing nothing. We're not treating the disease, doctor, therefore we're doing nothing. And so there's this culture that pretends to promote that concept. So those are some things that we might think about. So let's take a look at a case, and you can just kind of think for yourself how you might answer this. And so this is a 75-year-old patient who presents with a rapid weight loss of 20 pounds in 6 weeks and the onset of type 2 diabetes mellitus requiring insulin. Patient not been on insulin previously. The patient's family indicates that she spends over half her time in bed, has no appetite, and complains of back and abdominal pain. CT scan reveals a large mass in the head of the pancreas and multiple hepatic metastases. The best approach for this patient is A, multi-agent chemotherapy, B, single-agent chemotherapy, C, gastrojejunostomy to avoid obstruction, D, radiation therapy, or E, supportive care with hospice referral. So kind of think about what you would think the best approach would be. Now, always, this is another thing to remember when you're looking at board exam questions. The best approach for the patient may not necessarily be the right approach for the patient or the approach that you might take or the thing that you might do. But given the scenarios and what you know about this patient, which of the options that would be presented would be best in that situation? And the answer here is that it's going to be, well, we didn't get the finger quite all the way down, but it's supportive care with hospice referral. And we'll talk about why that's the case based on some of the information. So we can do a lot of things in oncology these days, but as we've seen this whole process, this whole field develop over about the last 150 years, we have seen that there's a lot of complexity that's involved in the decision-making process. And the real world is that as we proceed farther into our treatment modalities, we have declining efficacy. We really try to put our best foot forward and give patients the best option available to us. When the cancer finds ways to get through that, our subsequent options tend to be less efficacious. And they also tend to be the treatments that are more likely to promote toxicity. Toxicity that adds on in addition to the effects of the tumor, but from also the treatment that the patient has received to that point. So we've got some agents, some cancers out there that we think would be relatively chemosensitive. In other words, they'd be more likely to generate a tumor response or for whom treatment would improve overall quality of life. And on the left side of the slide, you can see things like germ cell tumors, lymphomas, leukemias. These tend to be diseases that tend to respond pretty favorably to therapy. And with the exception of acute leukemia, many of the treatments that we have can be tailored to the needs of patients who have a relatively low performance status. And we would probably take the risk because we think the potential benefit to be gained justifies the risk in that situation. If we move a little bit further to the right, we have some cancers that are a little bit less chemosensitive, but still are cancers that we would tend to think about. And they would be ovarian cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, bladder cancer, small cell lung cancer, and prostate cancer. I think we'd all agree there's some pretty ominous tumor types in that situation, but up front, these would be relatively chemosensitive tumors in most circumstances. So we move a little farther to the right. Now we begin to enter into the world where our treatment options are a little bit more problematic. Non-small cell lung cancer would factor into that, although we may be actually moving non-small cell lung cancer one box to the left with some of our newer therapies. It's a possibility. But the other cancers would be things like esophageal cancer, cervical cancer, pancreatic cancer, and gastric cancer. The likelihood that we're going to affect those tumors in a positive way is going to be substantially less. And so think about our case with a patient who presents with clinical findings that would represent stage 4 pancreatic carcinoma. We would think that it's going to be more of a chemo-resistant. And lastly, as you look to the far right of the slide, you see the situation where it's less likely that chemotherapy is going to generate a tumor response or improve quality of life. And here we would think about things like melanoma, hepatocellular carcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, or malignant gliomas. It's much less likely that we're going to have effective therapy in that situation. We also want to pick out patients who we're going to be more likely to be able to tolerate some of the rigors of treatment. And so look for those patients that are younger. They're going to tend to do better. They have fewer health problems associated with them. So naturally, we'd expect them to be able to tolerate the rigors of treatment better. Those patients who have a better performance status, those patients who have fewer comorbidities, less prior cancer treatment, no prior treatment-related toxicities, or treatments for which we have a target to address, so a targeted therapy, an actionable item that we can now address, or hormonal therapy. Those would be things where we would tend to think we'd have a relatively lower risk of treatment-related toxicity. Those patients, on the other hand, who are older or have a worse performance status, more comorbidities, more prior treatment, more treatment-related toxicities, or those patients who have received prior cytotoxic therapy, they're going to have a relatively higher risk for treatment-related toxicity as associated with the things that we're trying to do. So we've been alluding to this concept of performance status. We've kind of been using that term a lot this last couple of hours. There are two major performance status scales, the Karnofsky Performance Status Scale, also known as the KPS, and the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, also known as the ECOG or ZUBROD Performance Status Scale. And here you get a sense about how things interrelate. Now, the numbers really are just kind of a short-term descriptor of how active patients are. With the Karnofsky Performance Status, the lower the number, the more side effects and toxicities, the less active you are, the lower your performance status is. So think about us, otherwise healthy, fit people, no burdens in terms of symptoms, we're at 100%. If you're 0%, you've died as a result of your disease. And then you can kind of think of just a spectrum between 100% and 0% for how somebody's doing. The Zubrod performance status is actually a little bit more like a spelling test. The higher the number, the worse you did. So if you have a really good performance and you don't have any problems, your performance status is 0. At 5, you're deceased. So we normally describe 0 through 4. The patient who would be 4 would be bedridden in that particular situation. So, you kind of get a sense about how people do. I think realistically, though, we see these things all the time, and we may not describe it in terms of a performance status, but we can get a pretty good sense about how somebody's doing, can't we? So if they come into your office or clinic, and they just played 18 holes on the golf course, and if they carried their own bag, they get extra credit for that, then they just did great and they feel great. It's no small wonder that they're probably going to do better with any sort of treatment that you're going to recommend than the patient who came in a wheelchair being pushed in by the family. That's somebody who is not going to do as well. And so you get a sense in general about how these people are. So you may not have necessarily thought of it as performance status, but in the back of your mind, chances are really good that you've thought about that and you factored that into your decision-making process and caring for those patients. So in general, the things that we think about in terms of palliative chemotherapy, combination agents are appropriate where chemosensitivity exists and benefit of therapy and improving quality of life is established. Single agents are appropriate when that performance status is less than 3, so we're talking 0, 1, and 2, and chemosensitivity exists and benefit in improving quality of life is established. Targeted agents are appropriate where we've got the same patient set and the biomarker establishes sensitivity and the benefit of therapy and improving quality of life is established. So the key for targeted therapy is that you have a target. The biomarker that you're trying to measure, you have a target, that's an actionable item you can move with targeted therapy in that situation. Treatment of patients with poor performance status with chemotherapy is discouraged unless one of 3 conditions exist. One is we have a tumor with a known rapid response to therapy. So if you have somebody come in and they're weak and they're tired and they're feeling bad, but it's a gentleman with a seminoma, response rate in seminoma approaches 100% even in patients who are medically infirm. So we have a great opportunity to improve the quality of life of that patient. And it may very well be worth the burden of feeling worse for a short period of time with chemotherapy because we know that within 2 weeks, this person could be feeling substantially better. So that would be one particular situation. The other is that the patient is desirous of treatment and accepts the toxicities that are going to be associated with it. Or the third would be that the potential for improved quality of life is very real. So if you take that patient who has, let's say, some painful bony metastases, and we have a therapy that we know can result in substantial reduction in pain from bony metastases, that would be a realistic thing to at least consider. Those patients we would consider for types of therapy. Okay, we're going to turn next and we're going to talk a little bit about how to manage things radiotherapeutically. And here's a case of a 64-year-old man who presents with a known history of non-small cell lung cancer. And he comes in with a rapid onset of confusion. He had an unwitnessed loss of consciousness and there are concerns about a seizure. His restaging scans demonstrate widespread metastatic disease. An MRI of the brain is at the right. The best treatment option at this point is A, craniotomy and resection, B, multi-agent chemotherapy, C, whole brain radiation, D, intrathecal chemotherapy, or C, stereotactic radiosurgery. So kind of think for a moment about what you would choose in this situation if you're faced with this patient on a board exam. Think about the way you'd go. Well, the answer here is that this patient is going to need whole brain radiation, and let's talk maybe a little bit about why the other choices would be a little bit less desirable. Craniotomy and resection, well, you've probably got at least 15 separate lesions that you're going to have to resect, and as you kind of look at the scans, some of them are peripheral. But some of them are a little deeper within the brain, particularly in the occipital lobe. It's pretty tough to get that resected. So craniotomy and resection would probably not be the best option. Multi-agent chemotherapy. Well, the challenge that we face with multi-agent chemotherapy is that we can't get drugs in sufficient doses across the blood-brain barrier. Now, we've got some early studies that show that some of our newer agents may actually do a little better than some of the other agents that we've had historically. So that may change potentially, but I don't think it's changing fast enough that it's going to be an option for us on our current board examinations. Intrathecal chemotherapy can be very effective when we have what's called leptomeningeal disease, but this is generally a coating of the meninges and the ependymema with tumor in sheets. And so when you look at it on the inside, it just kind of looks literally like somebody has just painted the inside of the ependymema with tumor cells. Unfortunately, those patients don't live very long. Typically with treatment, a patient with leptomeningeal carcinomatosis lives about 8 weeks. It's a pretty devastating disease. And then lastly, stereotactic radiosurgery. Well, you can treat up to 6 lesions with stereotactic radiosurgery. It's really neat, it's convenient for the patient, it's outpatient. But you can count up very quickly and see that we have more than 6 lesions, multiple areas within the brain. And so what we need is something that goes everywhere. And that's what whole brain radiation therapy will do in that situation. Now, here's the good news. If we could give patients radiation therapy in a dose sufficient enough to eradicate tumor, we could actually kill 100% of the cancers that are out there. The challenge that we have, and the really bad news, is that we'd kill 100% of the patients doing it. So our normal tissues are very sensitive to radiation, some areas more sensitive than others. As the tumor volume increases, you need more radiation in order to have effective treatment. So think about the woman who comes in and she's got a couple of positive lymph nodes, has had conserving therapy for breast cancer, and they're going to do a boost in the axilla in an effort to control her disease. As you can see here, if you can get doses, say in the 40 to 50 gray range, you can result in an 80 to 90% subclinical 80 to 90% cure rate because her disease is subclinical at that point. It's not showing up on a scan and surgeons have gone in and removed it. So this is a very effective way of managing it. If you take a tumor 5 to 15 centimeters in size, 90 to 100 gray of radiation therapy, that's a substantial amount of radiation, and most patients are not going to be able to endure that. In fact, normal tissue, the brain is actually a pretty tough organ, but if you get over 6,000 centigray, the brain starts to necrose. Not really great if you're necrosing out to all your high school. With lens 500 centigray, you can start getting cataract formation. Optic chiasm will be fairly tolerant, but even if we get doses into the 5,000 centigray range, it can cause blindness. Spinal cord is tolerant up to about 5,000. Anything more than that can cause paralysis. Parotids, 3,200. And so on and on it goes. And you can see that our body's tissues are sensitive to radiation. And if we're giving radiation and chemotherapy together, which we sometimes do in treatment of things like lung cancer or lymphomas or some of the other diseases that we treat, these organs become innocent bystanders and they can be affected pretty substantially. So what we're really looking for here is this sweet spot denoted by the yellow arrow. And you can see where the failure rate drops as the dose increases, and the problem with side effects and toxicities goes up as the dose increases. And so we want to make sure we're trying to find that sweet spot when we're administering radiation. Well, when might we think about using palliative radiation therapy? Well, think about it. For painful bony metastases, it can be very effective. The bone is the most common metastatic site. We know that we can control pain and other symptoms in 65 to 75% of patients with advanced breast or prostate cancer, and 30 to 40% of patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Treatment can be given as multiple fractions over 2 to 3 weeks or as a single fraction. As it turns out, the single fraction method is as effective for patients who have an average lifespan of 4 months or less as the multiple fractions. So why do most radiation oncologists prefer to give multiple fractions? Well, it was because that's how they were trained. 30 gray and 10 treatments. It's pretty much ingrained in them. And, you know, admittedly, there is a little bit of a financial incentive, and they will admit that very, very readily. But if you're trying to treat for palliation, you're trying to minimize trips to the physician, and you're trying to minimize some of the other things so that patients have more time to do their thing and live the life the way they choose. And so it just seems that that the single fraction or maybe two fractions is just a better way to go. It's been a rather difficult thing to sell with radiation oncologists, but it's the right thing to do. We use palliative radiation therapy for spinal cord compression or for impending or pathologic fractures. We can use it for control of massive hemoptysis in those patients with lung cancer and for pelvic bleeding in patients with cervical, vaginal, vulvar, endometrial, and colorectal cancers. And as I've mentioned, we can utilize it for patients who have brain metastases as well. It is not valuable when death is imminent, and for that matter, neither is systemic chemotherapy of value. We've been working very hard as an oncology community to be sensitive and aware of that and try to ensure that patients are going to have effective therapy when they need it, but also that we're not administering treatments that really don't have the opportunity to be beneficial. It's not helpful when it's one symptom among many because we've got a lot of things. If the whole house is on fire, it really doesn't do any good to put the fire out in the bathroom if the kitchen and the bedrooms and the living room are on fire. If a patient's unable to give informed consent, not really valuable in that situation. Or if retreatment exceeds normal tissue tolerance, because we've got that issue, we want to make sure that we're not putting patients at risk. It's not really a value if there's a lengthy treatment course to be involved, or if a therapy facility is unavailable. Part of my practice historically had involved administering care in rural communities in the state of Missouri, and some of our patients would have to travel an hour or more to get to a radiation facility. So an hour in and an hour home, how long does it take to take a radiation treatment? About 3 to 5 minutes. So you're committing someone to essentially missing out a part of their day and probably relying on family to take a treatment that just takes a couple of minutes to administer. So it can be a real burden for a lot of our patients. We're going to spend the next couple of minutes just talking about common symptoms that come up in those patients who have malignancies, and we'll talk a little bit about nausea, vomiting, dyspnea, and then a little bit about depression. Now, if I don't make it all the way through these by the end of my time, you have the slides, and I think a quick review for those will be helpful to you as you prepare for boards. Nausea and vomiting affects about 60% of all terminal cancer patients and 40% of all cancer patients in the last 6 weeks of their life. 71% of patients who have nausea and vomiting ultimately wind up having to be admitted for control of their symptoms. So what you really want to do is to try to take a good history with your patients. You want to focus on the care and the character of the nausea and vomiting. Look at associated symptoms. Look at their medications that they're taking, any prior therapies, and their past medical history. Just get a good history on those patients. Common findings that we'll see are that there are some sort of chemical abnormalities in almost a third of their patients. Their electrolytes will be whacked. They'll have acidosis or alkalosis. Infection may be present causing nausea and vomiting. 44% of patients are going to have impaired gastric emptying. You might find visceral or serosal causes in about 31%. You might have patients with partial bowel obstructions. You might have patients with GI bleeding or peptic ulcer disease, with enteritis or constipation. Medications, 51% of the time, and when medications are involved, 83% of the time, it's due to opioids. So the best way to control nausea and vomiting is an understanding of the four pathways of nausea and vomiting. And think about the chemoreceptor trigger zone, the cortex, the peripheral pathways, and the vestibular system all playing a role in the overall cause for nausea and vomiting, and then express a willingness to try to work through some things and try to work through that. So if they give you a patient with nausea and vomiting, try to get as much history as you can, and I think you'll find that it will be effective. Non-pharmacologic therapy. Avoid strong smells or other triggers, so things like perfume and cologne. Oncology nurses are really, really good about this. This is not the place to try out the new perfume, not at work. If you want to try it out when you're away from work or something like that, You're certainly welcome to, but you'll find that oncologists and oncology nurses are really pretty good about keeping the cologne and perfumes to a minimum. Think about the patient who is dealing with other health problems. Think about sacral wounds and think about other pressure ulcers and things like that. They can be malodorous and the odor can trigger nausea and vomiting. So how can you manage that in a hospital setting? You can get some activated charcoal, put it underneath the bed. You can manage it with HEPA filters and things like that. In a home setting, you can do things like getting some kitty litter and putting it underneath the bed. It has chlorophyll in it. It works great if they don't have a cat. If they do have a cat, you got a bit of a problem with that because Sparky's probably going to find it and it may be more of an issue. But it can work great in a lot of situations. Small, frequent meals, and try to keep the meal out of the room until the patient's ready to eat. You'll see people come up and they've got lids on the trays. Well, the lids are great, but they do more than just keep the food warm. It keeps the odor and the smell to a minimum. Limit oral intake during severe episodes. So this is not a time to be guzzling water or anything like that. Relaxation techniques. If you can get people to kind of just learn to relax, and we've all had an episode of nausea and vomiting, it's an anxiety-provoking experience, isn't it? So you can imagine how our patients are going to feel if they're having to go through that anxiety-provoking experience several times a day. But we also now see that we can intervene in terms of trying to lower their anxiety level by just trying to do some relaxation techniques. They may be able to work through an episode of nausea without any medication at all. Acupuncture and acupressure have also been shown to be effective in managing this. So think about tools that you might be able to bring to bear in situations like this. We'll finish up with dyspnea. I just don't think I'm going to have time to get to anxiety and depression, but you'll have the notes for that. And I do see dyspnea as another place where there's going to be a fairly target-rich environment. So dyspnea affects 50 to 70% of cancer patients who have a life-limiting illness. It is a problem. Possible etiologies are going to include concomitant lung disease, deconditioning. These are people who have been ill for a while, probably are not active, and they're deconditioned as a result of it. The cachexia that occurs as a result of the malignancy. Pleural effusions, which can occur for a number of reasons and in a number of situations. You can also have obstruction from the tumor itself. Atelectasis, and sometimes the atelectasis can be so substantial that it effectively takes a lobe of the lung offline. You can have tumor that wraps around the arterial supply to the lung, and so you have a functional lobectomy. If it affects the hilum, it can be a functional pneumonectomy. And patients can develop lymphangitic metastasis as well. It's this restrictive process. You can listen to the lungs, and it sounds just like the paninspiratory dry Velcro crackles that you'd expect with interstitial lung disease. So those lymphangitic metastases can be a problem. So the thing that you have to do is to understand the symptoms, and you also have to be willing to consider that really the only reliable measure of dyspnea is patient self-reporting. This is really not something you can put a pulse oximeter on and measure. So you can put a pulse oximeter on, their SAT may be better than yours or mine. It may be 80, maybe 98, 99%, but they're still chugging away at 40 breaths per minute, and they feel really, really uncomfortable. Can't really focus on that. So you want to focus on identification and treatment, if possible, of the underlying cause of that. And you need to think about things like tumor obstruction. Well, in this situation, there are some things that we might be able to do. In those patients who are candidates for it, we might think about placing an endobronchial stent. We could think about laser ablation. There are some centers that have access to that and do it frequently. Many other centers do not, so it's something to consider. Radiation therapy might be a potential option. In patients who are appropriate candidates for it, you can think about resection of the metastasis itself to see if it offers some relief. I'm amazed with what surgeons can do with a thoracoscope these days. Steroids or chemotherapy, if indicated, might be other potential options. Excuse me. For chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, just the normal things that you would do to manage an exacerbation of COPD. Bronchodilators and steroids, good chest physical therapy, rib-raising lymphatic pump, the thing that we all learn as osteopathic physicians. For pneumonia, antibiotics are going to be the mainstay, along with some of the other chest physical therapy techniques that we've described. If it's heart failure, then you want to manage the heart failure. Diuretics, try to decrease their afterload, see if you can get some relief. What about if patients have treatment-related pneumonitis? Well, in that situation, glucocorticoids can be effective in helping. In many cases, it has to do with impaired diaphragmatic excursion because they've either got tumor or they've got massive ascites. In the case of ascites, you can drain, you can administer diuretics. They may be variably effective. If it's anemia that's causing the dyspnea, think about the trial of transfusion. And again, it's not so much on what their hemoglobin says, because you can argue for a trial of transfusion in a patient for palliative benefit, but you have to be honest with the patient about the risks and side effects of that transfusion, and you have to candidly tell them, you know, we may not see things go very far. And to finish up, the possibility of drainage with either thoracentesis or with a Pleurex catheter that can be inserted, and patients can do the drainage procedure on their own, is a possibility. Talc pleurodesis can help just glue the visceral and parietal pleura together to obliterate the space. You can also think about intrapleural chemotherapy with things like bleomycin and other agents as a potential benefit. Opioids can improve the feeling of breathlessness. Remember, they have a central and peripheral action. And oxygen, very powerful symbol of medical care. Patients may do just fine with a fan, but oxygen itself may very well help eliminate a lot of that. Of course, you have to be careful, know your patients well, beware of those patients who are CO2 retainers. Okay, so we're going to stop here, and I'll get out of Dr. Kowalski's way and let her continue on. Thank you.